We're back after a summer break. The last time we spoke to you together on this podcast was over a month ago. And then during that time, Kartik interviewed ESPN's head of soccer production, as well as Ian Dark, and a tactical breakdown with Danny Higginbotham. So what did we miss? Euro 2020 and Copa America is over. The Olympics begin on Wednesday. And in the meantime, the Gold Cup meanders along. Kartik, what would you say is your takeaway from Euro 2020? And it doesn't have to be TV production-wise. It could be if you want it to be. But what for you will you remember Euro 2020 for?
I think very much kind of the... And it's funny because Jonathan Wilson, it was a working thesis of mine, and then now confirmation bias. Jonathan Wilson has written about it in The Guardian, so I now know I'm right, of course, because Wilson wrote about it. But that we've gone from this era of like superstar players, which in the article Wilson wrote, he basically said Copa America hasn't gotten away from that. It's all about Neymar versus Messi or whatever combination of players. So maybe that's why the South American game is lagging. But we've gotten away from this era of superstar players and individual players into very much a team ethos. You could argue England doesn't have the level of superstar they once did. They're better than they've ever been, or at least since 1966, maybe better than that even. Italy doesn't have a superstar. Their team ethos has gotten them back to the very top of the mountain. Spain, who were dominated by stars in their previous golden era, now have really virtually no stars, or aging stars, fading stars like Busquets. They're as good as they've been since the end of that golden era from 2008 to 2012. Denmark, you take the one star they have away from them in Christian Eriksen, and they get better. And get to the semifinals, and maybe we're unlucky to not be in the finals. So that's my takeaway. It's now we're now entering an era of superior teams and systems in international football. Yeah. Oh, and I should say the flip side is the three teams that were littered with stars, Belgium, Portugal, and France, all bombed out at quarterfinals or before.
Yeah, I would say my takeaway is just the increased quality level. Talent level. When you look at the Euro 2020, I can't think of any bad sides. I mean, all the teams that were performing in this tournament, and there were quite a lot of surprises. I think you're probably the exception to this, Kartik, but I think probably a lot of people were surprised by how good Austria was, how good Switzerland was, how well Scotland did. To me, they exceeded my expectations of what I thought that they would accomplish. And I don't think there were any teams in this tournament that were poor. Everything, I mean, Slovakia was strong. I mean, you go down the list, there was a lot of strong teams.
Even North Macedonia, they lost all three matches, but they were in all three matches at one point, and actually had a number of disallowed goals and controversial calls in their games also.
So what about Copa America? So before I ask you what your kind of thought on that was, or kind of your takeaway from that, going back to something you said a minute ago, talking about the team ethos and how important that is, it seems that Fox Sports are behind the times, because if you watched any of their Copa America coverage, it was individual against individual. It was Messi against Neymar. It was Alexis against Miguel Almirón. I mean, throughout the entire month of their coverage, they had the big giant TV screens in the background, and they kept on focusing on one player versus one player. And it was even to the point of, I think, one of the U.S. women's national team friendlies where they played Mexico, and it was, I don't know, Megan Rapinoe against, and I'm not sure even who it was or what her name was. I can't remember. I apologize. But one of the Mexican players. Well, the Mexican female team, I don't think, has any players at or near a level in terms of popularity of a Megan Rapinoe by any means. So they were stretching on that one for sure. But you mean it seems to be. I'm in agreement, Kartik, with you about the team ethos. But what for you was your takeaway from Copa America?
Well, as I said, Jonathan Wilson in his article in The Guardian mentioned that the team ethos is not applying to South American countries, and they're still very much dependent on individuals, which is maybe why, because, you know, Wilson really likes South American football and rates it. That might be why we're seeing European countries emerge in World Cups as the winners and the teams generally getting to the semifinals and finals. That he doesn't believe the talent level is any different in South America. He believes Argentina and Brazil have as much talent as Italy or Spain. However, there is now this very kind of system-oriented football coming out. Well, it came out of Spain a while ago, but now that has hit Italy, has hit England, that has hit other countries. So I think the takeaway for me on Copa America was that it's awfully difficult to go through a tournament, a group stage of a tournament, where I was taking matches pretty seriously, to have only one team eliminated from each group. And this is setting up for me to be a major disaster as FIFA moves to this 48-team World Cup, where 32 teams will make the knockout stage in 2026. I realized after the group stage of Copa America that it was a waste of time, because effectively four teams advanced from each group. We played all those matches to eliminate the two teams that would probably be eliminated anyway, right? The two worst teams on the South American continent. So that's my takeaway, unfortunately, Chris, is that looking ahead to what FIFA is planning for the 2026 World Cup, and a tournament where you have a short group stage, but two of the teams get out of each group of three team groups. I think the group stage then is a waste.
Yeah, and not only that, though, Kartik, but this week, and we've heard rumblings about this previously, but this week FIFA talking about the possibility of going every 2 years for World Cups instead of every 4 years. So you can just imagine even having, you know, 48, 54, 52, however many teams it would be every 2 years. I mean, in that case, just get rid of the whole qualification process.
Yeah.
The other thing about Copa America is before this tournament even begun, it felt like, I mean, let's just go ahead and just Brazil against Argentina and just play one game and call it the Copa America final and that's it. Because the chances are we're very likely that those two teams would be in the final anyway. And no offense to Colombia or any of the other teams that certainly battled hard and gave those teams a run for the money to try to make it into the final. But it did seem very likely, just the way also the groups were set up too, that it would be, you know, Brazil against Argentina in the final. Same thing with Gold Cup. It's very likely it'll be USA against Mexico. I mean, that's the game that, I mean, seemingly everybody wants. CONCACAF wants, US men's national team wants, Mexico wants. Everyone wants to see that in the final. My takeaway for Copa America is just how different the game is played in that competition versus what we're used to seeing. And it was extremely more physical, and a lot of it comes down to the officiating, where the referees just let things go, but let things go where they get out of control. I think the first week of Copa America, almost every single game, there were fights on the field. Yeah. Like the two teams kind of coming up against each other because of a harsh tackle or a late tackle, or whatever it may be. Referee gets involved, tries to break it up. It was almost every single game I watched that had that. And you take that and then compare it to, I don't know, Champions League final or something like that, and the way that those two games are played out and officiated, it's almost like you have two different sports. You have a very rough, physical type style of play versus not very well officiated. You have something that's on the other side of the spectrum where it's almost too officiated, where the referee's getting involved a lot. I mean, stepping down early in the game to, you mean, show a yellow card, which sets the tone for the game, and then it becomes very, I mean, a very close game with not a lot of harsh fouling. So there's pros and cons to both sides, but that was my takeaway from Copa America.
I think you've hit on something else, which is the number. There weren't that many bad challenges in the Euros. I mean, we didn't see the sort of – and this to me was – I think you and I had an offline conversation, private conversation about this after the first set of group games, that you didn't have kind of the cynical challenges and physical games you typically have in the first round of group stage games in any competition, whether it be the Euros, Copa we certainly had it. You were just describing that. The World Cups, generally you have that in any competition, and you did it in this. And then the other thing was that the number of teams in the competition that were willing to have a go. Switzerland against France, they dominated that first half. Then fell behind 3-1, right? But then came back and ended up advancing. But they dominated the first half. Italy, who were the best team in the tournament, were thoroughly outplayed, I think, in the second half, or at least from minutes 45 to 75 by Austria in the round of 16. And you can go through more examples of that. You can go through large portions of matches where the team you would think would be on the back foot and would be sitting deep and trying to absorb pressure were going and having a go at the perceived better team. And that was something that I didn't expect coming into the tournament. I mean, as much as I – and you said it wasn't a surprise to me that Switzerland and Austria were so good in this tournament. I tipped them both because I probably have some built-in bias towards the Bundesliga because it's the league I like the best. I didn't have much confidence in my picks of them to be surprise teams, and as it turns out, they both did well. But that to me was like a big part of it, the lack of cynicism and overly physical play. I mean, I think the only team we saw really subjected to that was Spain, because Spain has so much of the ball and have so many ways they can beat you. Luis Enrique has integrated more of a direct style at times in how Spain plays. They're still very vertical, tiki-taka, not vertical, horizontal in that, but then they have a vertical game to go with it. And if their finishing were a little better from Moreno and Morata throughout the tournament, I think they would have won it. But that's the only team you saw the opposition really kind of say, hey, we don't want to play with them. The other 23 teams were all kind of on the same level playing against one another.
So we will get to talking about the television coverage in our listener mailbag section. We'll go a little bit deeper into that. But one more thing, Kartik, before we move on to the TV streaming news section, is one of the things that so was a huge point of discussion throughout Euro 2020, and there were two sides of the fence on this one. There was very few people that sat on the fence, but the amount of vitriol and dislike for Taylor Twellman in this competition as a co-commentator was enormous. I mean, you had so many people posting comments on social media, on worldsoccertalk.com, just people really, really upset with him being the co-commentator. And I know you value him. I value him too. But it seems to be, I mean, the actual criticism about him didn't seem to be filled with he said this or there was something specific that he said or did. A lot of it just seemed to be that he had an American accent. That was my feeling, was that if you put somebody else in that same spot, maybe it was Taylor, and Taylor had a British accent, I don't think there'd be as much criticism placed on him or directed at him. But he is American. He is good. He's one of the best, if not the best, co-commentator in the United States. I thought he did really well, and some games are better than others. But I think part of it seems to be that just there's definitely a lot of hate towards Major League Soccer among soccer fans, and soccer fans of all sorts of different likes and dislikes, from within the United States, whether they're fans of Serie A or Liga MX or the Bundesliga or the Premier League or whatever it may be. But I think a lot of it is baggage, where they kind of take out a lot of their criticisms about Taylor Twellman because he is so associated with Major League Soccer. He is such, he's one of the ESPN's lead co-commentator for Major League Soccer, and then having him do the games for ESPN on the Euro 2020, being the lead co-com, that's my take on it. What about you, Kartik? What are you, What do you make of all of this? I mean, do you think that it was fair?
No, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, I think you have an inherent bias among a lot of American fans. Now, some of them, I agree, are the kind of the bros, if you want to call them that, that hate anything associated with Major League Soccer. I saw definitely some of that. And people who some of these people are people, and because I'm generally on their side of most of these ideological debates within U.S. soccer, but you could be 99% with them and they assume you're an MLS shill. I mean, I've had some of the people who were attacking Twellman, actually, on Twellman attack on Twitter, attack me saying, oh, I thought you were a big MLS guy, even though I agree with them on everything. I just understand, because I've worked in the game in front offices, that you can't just blow things up and it'll change overnight. There are gradual incrementalism that needs to take place, and that there's also a value you put on the fact that there are things in MLS that work to develop certain American players, and there are things in our system, USL and in the lower divisions, that are working. Most of it doesn't work, but some of it does. So by saying some of it does, you disqualify yourself in some of these people's eyes. That's the Twellman problem with them, right? Twellman is as critical of the system and the problems within the system as anyone out there in the media, with the exception of probably among the former players, with the exception of Hercules Gomez, of people who are on a lot. But he gets that. Now, the other aspect, though, Chris, is something that I think is more it's a larger segment of the audience and it's more serious, which is the Premier League fan, the American Premier League fan that is English language dominant, that doesn't watch any domestic soccer, that wants everything delivered with an English accent and a certain style. And quite honestly, some of the co-commentators for Premier League matches are terrible. And they don't give you the amount of information or historical data that Twellman does. So now you get them saying, well, he talks too much, he says too much, he needs to shut up, like the co-commentators we have doing Premier League games. But he's giving you a lot more information. I mean, in fact, during the Spain-Italy penalty shootout, he and Champion were going back and forth talking about specific penalty situations from past Euro tournaments.
Yeah, I see.
And Twellman...
Yeah, go ahead.
Twellman even knew where German players had made penalties or missed in the past, in past knockout stage matches, which I think is maybe information overload for a lot of these people. Maybe that's their problem.
He definitely did his homework on the penalty kicks, but I think it was the final, right? The Italy-England final. And I thought that was too much, because he was like, okay, the last time, I don't know, Jorginho took the penalty kick, he kicked it to the right, to the goalkeeper's left, whatever it may be. It just, I mean, he went on. To me, for when it's penalty kicks, if I'm a viewer, I would rather the co-commentator get out of the way. Just let the lead commentator give us an idea of what the score is at. I mean, it's, I don't know, it's 2-2 now, going into the third round of penalty kicks. But to me, I don't want to know where that player kicks the ball last, or where the goalkeeper which way he dives. I just want to enjoy, well, I hate penalty kicks, but I just want to watch the penalty kicks taking place in front of me. I don't want the co-commentator telling me what to expect. To me, the whole thing about penalty kicks is the spontaneity of it. In reality, yes, there isn't a lot of spontaneity in it, because both the penalty kickers and the goalkeepers do their homework. So it's almost like a chess match. But for me, that was one thing that I didn't like about Taylor's commentary. And that's the thing at the end of the day, is that we all have our likes and dislikes. And I think with Taylor Twellman, it's like you and I, Kartik, you might like the Beatles, I might like the Rolling Stones. And I mean, like certain co-commentators better than others because they fit my style more. But it was just interesting on the sidelines watching this throughout the whole Euro 2020, and just the amount of, I mean, yes, there was positivity towards Taylor too. A lot of people saying how good he was, but the majority of people seemed to be more negative, or at least the vocal minority, perhaps. But they were very vocal about that. But yeah, no, for me personally, I really, really enjoyed the tournament, and I thought ESPN's coverage got better as the tournament went along. The other thing about Taylor Twellman, though, Kartik, I would say, is that Personally speaking, I would much prefer to see Taylor Twellman in the studio, be a studio analyst, and he's good as a co-commentator, but I think he's better as a studio analyst, where whether it's the tactics board, whether it's getting into a debate with some of the experts in the studio, or whether it's just some of the things he says, I would much prefer that in a studio analysis point of view. Now, I'm sure I'd love to be at Wembley being co-commentator and doing a studio analysis, but if I had to pick my personal preference for where Taylor is best, I think it's in the studio. All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news, and we'll come back to more talk about ESPN, Fox, and other, Copa America, Gold Cup, Euros, etc., in the listener mailbag section. But I'll have you hit it up first with some news to bring listeners up to date with.
Yeah, this was big news toward the end of last month. Again, we haven't done this format of the show in a month. YouTube is going to stream all the women's UEFA Champions League matches for free to those of us in the U.S. and in most territories, Europe. I think North Africa and the Middle East is the one area of the world that they're not going to be doing this. DAZN will be responsible for the production and the broadcasting, but it will be free. It won't be behind a DAZN paywall, and this deal will run through 2025. So fantastic news. The Women's Champions League has gotten better and better each year. I know a lot of NWSL fans don't like me saying that. That's become another thing in America, in U.S. soccer fandom, that we can talk about another time. This NWSL fan saying, hey, the Champions League, European leagues aren't as good as you think they are. But this is really exciting. I think it's going to be very important for people who want a balanced perspective on the women's game in the U.S. to be able to watch these. And again, it will not be behind a DAZN paywall, but it will be DAZN broadcast. And I'm sure DAZN will be incentivizing you to sign up for their packages, for DAZN, their premium packages during the broadcast.
Yeah, what it does show us also, Kartik, is the continued fractured nature of soccer in the United States. There's so many choices, so many games available on any given weekend. Well, during the height of a season, there's about 60 to 80 games available per day. And you've got viewers and listeners such as ourselves picking and choosing. I mean, whether it's watching the Women's UEFA Champions League games for free on YouTube, watching Premier League, MLS, USL, Serie A, I mean, you name it, South American soccer, African soccer, soccer from around the world. So what it does is it really kind of sets us apart in many ways, because the viewing numbers for some of these big games probably are not as great as they used to be, where that was the only game in town on that particular afternoon. Now there might be like 15 to 20 other choices happening at the same given time. So I think the soccer viewership universe in the United States is growing, but it has become more fractured. And if you look at the TV ratings for those games that are available, somebody from outside soccer might look at that and go like, I don't think soccer's that big. Look, this game only got 300,000 viewers, or this game only got 250,000 viewers. Well, there might have been 10 or 15 other games going on at the same time. Next news item is that Univision's Prende TV has picked up Spanish language rights to select Brasileiro and Argentine League games. So each weekend, about 2 to 3 games on Prende TV, which is their free streaming service. At the same time, Fanatis will continue to show all the games from the Brazilian League and all the games from the Argentine League. So this looks like it's a deal that Fanatis did with Univision to go ahead and sublicense out some of the games from Brazil and Argentina, and then make those available through Prende TV. But also, again, there are still all the games are on Fanatis, both for Brazilian League and the Argentine League. And don't forget, too, Paramount Plus has the rights to these games in English language through the Paramount Plus streaming service. Speaking of Paramount Plus, Kartik, maybe give us some insight in terms of some of their plans coming up.
Yeah. We understand that Matteo Bonetti, who did broadcast the Euros with Mark Donaldson, several matches for ESPN and has done Serie A the last 3 years at ESPN and before that at BN, is likely to join CBS Sports and Paramount Plus for their coverage of Serie A next season, while another former South Florida-based BN personality, actually was with Gold TV also, Dre Cordero, will likely be calling La Liga games on ESPN Plus, which is very interesting news. There was there have been rumors floating around previously, Chris, that that ESPN was just going to give us the world feed for everything La Liga related. That appears not to be the case. I'm sure many of the matches will be world feed, but Dre Cordero, we're told, likely to be calling some matches, select matches for ESPN on ESPN Plus for La Liga.
Yeah, so Serie A, the new season begins on August 21st, live on Paramount Plus. What do you think, Kartik? Do you think they'll do the studio from the UK or the US?
CBS, yeah, I believe they'll do it from the UK. I think it's also really strategic in terms of the world feed for Serie A, where you hear some of the names we're all kind of familiar with, including Stuart Robson, who was very prominent on the ESPN during the Euro tournament. IMG operates their Serie A world feed in English out of the very same studio. So I think it's just a good synergy where it may give CBS more options, even as far as studio programming, bringing in some of those commentators and co-commentators to CBS's studio at times if they're not calling a match. In Serie A, incredibly competitive last year. They were six really good teams in Serie A last year. And now this season, we're anticipating a seventh team, Roma, under Jose Mourinho, to be there. So I think they'll do it out of London.
Yeah, so we've got Serie A move into Paramount Plus, and we've got La Liga move into ESPN Plus. And we have on the homepage of worldsoccertalk.com, we have FAQs for both both Paramount Plus and Serie A, as well as La Liga and ESPN Plus, that go into a lot more detail about their coverage plans and what we know so far. There will be news coming up in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure, about more details regarding those coverage plans, for sure. And last but not least, the UEFA Euro 2020 final on ESPN, Univision and TUDOANE set a record as the most watched European Football Championship match ever in the United States, with an audience of 9.3 million viewers. On ESPN, the viewership was 6.4 million, and then Univision scored 2.9 million viewers. Kartik, 9.3 million, bigger than you thought, or just about there?
Yeah, no, much bigger than I thought. I think that they really benefited from who were in the final, because England has a built-in following in the U.S. for various reasons, particularly Premier League fans. You know, I know so many it's very weird. I know many Premier League American fans, right, and kind of your classic white, suburban, upper-middle class liberal person that root for England's national team and don't care about the U.S. men's national team. So a number of those sorts of people are watching England. And then there's the Italian ethnic audience in the U.S., which, unlike the German ethnic audience and the Spanish ethnic audience, does get behind the Azzurri, right? Does get involved, does start watching Italy in tournament football, and gets very nationalistic, even if they're not paying attention to soccer the rest of the year, right? They get involved in these summer tournaments. So I think it was an ideal final, particularly on the English language side for ESPN. The Univision number was surprisingly high at close to 3 million, but ideal final, but still, if it had been Spain and Denmark, which it very easily could have been, I think the numbers probably would have been pretty high. Not quite this high, but would have been pretty high. There was more mainstream interest in this Euros than any previous Euros. And I have to say, Chris, to a large extent, it felt like there was more mainstream interest than World Cups outside of U.S. games. Now, that may be a bit of a leap of faith or a leap in commentary by me, but it just felt that way based on kind of historic factors. And we know people watch World Cup finals and World Cup semifinals, but it tends to always be kind of an ethnic audience or just a casual audience. But it felt like this entire tournament people were following. And really, starting with maybe not the first weekend and the Ericsson situation, but that France-Germany game, the first Monday of the tournament, 3 days after the tournament kicked off. I think from that point, it felt like it was a very mainstream sporting event, which I don't think we could ever say about the Euros in the past, and often doesn't even feel like it for a World Cup outside of U.S. games until very late in a World Cup.
Yeah, and also, I guess, Copa America final on FS1, that one had, if I remember correctly, for the final, 1.8 million viewers watched that game. And again, on ESPN, the viewership was 6.4 million. So you had Brazil against Argentina with arguably two of the best players in the world out of the three. I mean, Neymar and Messi, 1.8 million, and then ESPN with 6.4 million. For Italy, great team ethos against England, great team ethos, but neither of those two teams had stars of the level of a Neymar or a Messi. So it goes back to your whole team approach, Kartik. Well, there's many different variables, but the team ethic and the quality of that ESPN broadcast, which we'll get to in a little bit, was top-notch indeed. Listener mailbag. First up is Dave. Dave says, I am enjoying your series of interviews, and this was especially interesting, the interview with Danny Higginbotham. My tactical knowledge is minimal, and I generally prefer my team to have a strong goal scorer and to take risks, such as a high press or a high line, etc. I particularly liked learning from Danny Higginbotham about why many successful teams do not do the things I prefer, and what some teams are trying to achieve with formations, spacing, and mismatches. Neelan says, thanks for this interview. I have tons of respect for Ian Dark, and it's great to hear his thoughts on these things. I've been fascinated with the commentator approach ever since I saw Nick Barney's beautiful notes, which I think were originally published in 8x8 magazine a while back. Ian is football royalty in my book, and if there's ever a chance to hear about his process as a commentator, I'd love to hear more. And then last but not least, in terms of the mailbag, as far as interview feedback, Chris Guardino says, I have been enjoying these series of interviews, especially the one Kartik did with Ian Dark. This week's pod with Danny Higginbotham I found interesting because it provided a level of analysis regarding tactics that explained a lot in terms of how the modern game is played. Danny Higginbotham did an excellent job, in my view, of breaking them down so that the average fan could understand why certain teams play in a certain style. Even though this episode was focused on the Euros, I would love to see a similar episode done with the Copa America and the tactical trends that came out of that competition. So yeah, full credit to Kartik for doing the interviews with Ian Dark, with Amy Rosenfeld, and with Danny Higginbotham. We wanted to mix things up a little bit, especially with the summer tournaments too, and where there's like three games a day from the Euros and usually two games a day from the Gold Cup, from Copa America, as well as two games a day from Gold Cup. We know that most soccer fans probably are not going to be listening to as many podcasts as usual because, I mean, most of the time is spent watching games and thinking about those games. So we mixed things up a little bit, took a little bit of a break, but then had Kartik do those interviews. And yeah, I enjoy them, Kartik. I thought they were really, really good.
Appreciate that. Yeah, and I learned a lot from the interviews myself. I mean, listening to Danny Higginbotham, what a wealth of knowledge he is. And in terms of Amy Rosenfeld, learned so much about the production and talent side and just the operations, if you will, of broadcasting major tournaments. And then obviously Ian Dark is a legend. So it speaks for itself being able to have a chance to talk with him.
Aram says, I'm curious to know which extra time format you and Kartik prefer, Copa America, which goes straight to penalties after 90 minutes, or the Euros. Personally, I prefer skipping extra time since these tournament games are every 4 days or so, and these players are coming off grueling club seasons. Plus, it would be better for broadcasters since they'd have a predictable broadcast window for every match. This was interesting, Kartik, because I think for the games that did go through extra time in the Euros, I don't think they were the predictable extra time that we've had in previous tournaments where it's been 30 minutes of just nothing, of teams being very conservative. I thought these were actually pretty entertaining for the most part.
Yeah, especially the Austria-Italy extra time, which was filled with goals, and Italy scored twice, Austria scored once, and Austria could have scored another goal or two, right? They could have even taken that match in extra time. I have been partial to the 90 minutes and penalties historically. In fact, the league, the adult league I manage in Florida, I have I changed the rules and made it 90 and then pens instead of the extra time for the reasons you outline, which the extra time would always be very predictable. Teams would be very negative. Guys would be getting injured. I think the only example of that I can think of in the tournament in the Euros was the Ukraine Sweden game. Even though Ukraine got a winner in extra time, I just felt like guys were getting hurt. There were some really, I talked about there not being many cynical challenges in the extra time or in the Euros, but I think there were multiple cynical challenges from Sweden in that extra time period as Ukraine was getting more on the front foot. You had a guy sent off. But yeah, I'm partial to the 90 minute and penalties, but Chris, you make a good case, and I'm hedging after this tournament because extra time was filled with a lot of drama in many of the matches. It wasn't as predictable as normal, and we didn't have the cynicism we typically have, except obviously in that one example I mentioned, Ukraine-Sweden.
Kartik, I'm laughing to myself a little bit here, but what I would prefer to see is taking away penalties. So if it's playing 30 minutes of extra time and then playing, I don't know, an additional 15 minutes, but playing each team's playing two men down or something, so it's 9v9, some other solution than penalty kicks. I mean, I realize that games have to finish, have to end. They can't just keep on going on and on. But and this might be just for, I mean, kind of sadness that England didn't win that penalty contest. But I don't think it's that. No matter when it is, I just feel that penalties is just such a crapshoot, a way to decide a game that it's really. It's really, I don't know. There's got to be a better way. And you mean penalties? I don't think is it.
There is a better way.
No.
NESL/MLS shootout. No, Chris, it's much more skillful. I mean, the penalty kicks are penalty kicks are a crapshoot. I completely agree with that. It depends on whether a keeper guesses right or a guy. For all the Panenka moments, right? Czechoslovakia defeats West Germany in the 76 Euro final on that Panenka penalty. It's just guys missing or guys getting lucky with their dives. I would argue the MLS-NASL shootout, the MLS had it the first four seasons of MLS, it was in the old NASL, is much more skill. It involves skill. So yeah, if you're going to have a tiebreaker, do that. If you don't need a tiebreaker, I say, yeah, I agree, play on. But if you play on, you have to allow unlimited substitution. So that would be the one caveat.
So I agree with you, Kartik. I think that is a better way. The reason why I'm against it or have a lot of bad memories about it is because I was watching so many MLS games in the late 90s, early 2000s, where it'd be an entertaining game. Maybe it was New York Red Bulls against New York MetroStars at the time against, I don't know, Miami Fusion or Tampa Bay Mutiny, whatever. It'd be a great game, 3-3 game just in the regular season. Wonderful game. And then the game ends 3-3. Okay, great. That's a game, a regular season game where both teams should walk away with 1 point. But no. We have the MLS shootout, and then it becomes almost like a circus to try to decide who's going to have the, I don't know, 2 points or 3 points, whatever it was back then, to walk away with the victory from those. And to me, that wasn't practical. It was meaningless. Yeah. It was like, if a game ends 3-3 and it's an entertaining draw, that's it. That's fine. Walk away. Every game does not have to end in a victory, a win or a loss. But for a European championship, yeah, I guess, yeah, that is more skill, that is more entertaining, that would be better than having penalties. I agree with you. I have a lot of bad bad memories, but bad experiences being at games where sometimes at the end of regulation time I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna leave, I'm gonna go home, because to me, in my mind, that ended a draw. I was happy with that result of that game. Why should I have to now sit through 15 to 20 minutes of MLS shootouts just to have a winner, which is completely relatively meaningless at the end of the day.
There were also, I should say, in the MLS period, 96 to 99, or 2000? No, I think 2000, they did away with the penalties, right? That was the year that we had the two periods of extra time in regular season matches, which made no sense either. And then if it ended level, it was a tie. But then they finally went to universal international rules, I think, in 2001. But there were a disproportionate number of injuries in the shootout because keepers are coming off their line at full speed. And so that was, in fact, an injury. One prominent injury I remember was an injury Eric Winalda got when he was still playing for San Jose, not before he came to the Fusion. And that disrupted his prep for the 98 World Cup, which, as we know, was a disaster. And we now subsequently know there was other stuff going on off the field with Winalda and former teammates at the time, which dogged the U.S. prep also. But there were a lot of injuries. And when you're talking about tired players after 120 minutes, that could be an issue. My preference, Chris, is just to play on and allow unlimited subs. But I know that purists will get angry about too. So, I don't know.
All right, let's continue. So now the listener mailbag, we've got a bunch of continuous feedback about the Euros and ESPN's coverage. First up is JP. JP says the announcers on ESPN have been mostly awful. I may be biased because it seems that almost every match I've watched was called by Alejandro Moreno or Twelman. The world feed is almost always better, but we know the networks like to use in-house talent so they can promote other offerings from the network. Simple as that. Same for ESPN using their own score time bug. With regards to a timeline for tournaments going streaming, I think that misses the point. No one is calling for streaming only, asking for a streaming option. ESPN can show the matches on cable or over the air, while at the same time allowing it to simulcast on ESPN Plus. Either way, getting their approximately $5 per subscriber, this just isn't an ESPN critique, and it applies to a lot of other streaming services and broadcasters too. What was interesting, Kartik, I think, and I missed this, but I know that there was all of the controversy about ESPN Plus and their coverage of the tournament because they weren't showing what some people thought they would show. But the final, I didn't watch it, but I watched the final on TV, but from what I understand, the final on ESPN Plus, they showed the full match broadcast, which I thought was interesting. But probably by that point, they thought, okay, well, let's just go ahead and show it because it's going to be too much criticism otherwise.
Yeah, that's actually surprising. I wasn't aware of that until now that they did that.
One more thing, actually, before we move on to listener mailbag, continue with that is I apologize for not having your name available right now to mention it, but someone emailed me and said, like, "Hey, Chris, did you realize that Bleacher Report Live is no longer in business?" And I was like, "Okay, well, I knew that at some point they were going to go ahead and take BR Live and put that into the Bleacher Report." Well, it happened in June. I think nobody knew about it, unless you're a BR Live subscriber. 2 years ago, Kartik, we were probably talking a lot about BR Live and about, Champions League coverage, Europa League coverage. They were having basketball where they were showing, I think, the last 5 minutes of a game. You could subscribe to pay, I don't know, $5 or $10 to watch the last few minutes of a game. It was talk of the town, and then it sails off into the distance and is no more, and there's no announcement, there's no news about it. So that I thought was pretty interesting. All right, let me continue here. So Disco George says, "Kind of funny, I just finished the podcast at halftime of the Turkey-Wales match, and I noticed that the next break between matches featured a little more tactical analysis than I'd seen previously. First, Chris Coleman and Julie Foudy were breaking down how Wales kept getting through the Turkish back line. And then there was a Taylor Twellman, Alessandro Del Piero preview on what to look for in Italy. I wonder if some of the niceness on the ESPN set is kind of a cultural thing as well. After over a year of people trying to be kinder and give each other the benefit of the doubt, and then watching a player almost die on the pitch during the opening weekend of the tournament, I'm not surprised that nobody really wants to be that person ready to fight over a 4-3-3 versus a 4-3-1-2 especially among what is more or less a group of strangers or acquaintances. The ESPN FC group is so familiar with each other that the dynamic is a lot more banter-driven and comfortable. There's an established culture that the pre- and post-game group doesn't have, especially with a rotating cast. I think things have to improve as the stakes get higher, and there's more to analyze after this first round of group stage matches. So this comment came in probably a couple of weeks ago, and this would have come in right after we did the podcast about our first impressions of ESPN's coverage, and after probably the opening weekend. And I agree with Disco George. The first impressions of ESPN's coverage were not good, but I think a lot of that was because a lot of these analysts hadn't spent much time together, and because of COVID, and were coming fresh into the studio and trying to develop a chemistry and trying to even provide analysis. It takes time, and as the tournament went on, it got better and better. And I think from the production's point of view too, I think they probably figured out who was the best people to put on the set at any given time, and who had the best chemistry. And there were different people who brought on board. Neda Manoha, who you interviewed also, and Sami Khedira joined a little bit later. So as it went on, I think it got better and better, but there was definitely that niceness about it. It felt very professional, it felt very cultured, and it didn't feel like previous ESPN's coverage of the World Cup, where it was more debate driven. So I think it was still good, Conte. I still enjoyed it. It was just a lot different than I thought it would be.
Agree. I think one of the things that I hadn't considered that first week when I was critical of ESPN's coverage was the chemistry wasn't quite there because of COVID, and they didn't have the sort of, and Amy Rosenfeld got into this with us in the interview I did with her, we didn't have the sort of bonding and group team building exercises that they do before major tournaments normally. And secondly, they weren't on site, so and they were in Bristol, but even within the confines of everyone being in Bristol, there were limitations to how much interaction they could have before the tournament. And then you mentioned Anua, Khedira, they come in after the first week. But I think it got better. I think it ended up being very good by the end and became fairly edgy. It just wasn't that first week. I agree with Disco George.
Yeah, and I think Del Piero got better too as the tournament went along. Of course, it helped that Italy did so well, but I thought his analysis was really good, and I thought it was very from the heart. It felt very honest, and he was pouring his soul out there. He was, in terms of the highs and the lows, but mostly highs. But I really enjoyed that. That was kind of a standout moment for me. Last comment before we move on to discussion of the Copa and Gold Cup. This comes from Mike Sale. Mike says, I thoroughly enjoyed watching the Euros, but unfortunately I felt the entire tournament was tarnished by the poor behaviour of the English fans during the Germany and Denmark games, and especially after the final. The irony in this is that the English squad taking a knee before each match to highlight the abuse and racial injustice in European football. I also can't forget the hardline stance of Hungary toward the LGBTQ plus community. My question is this: why didn't ESPN, which is a well-known for its documentaries such as Behind the Lions and 30 for 30, do a story on these ongoing problems in European football? It's not like the England squad just randomly decided one day to take a knee, or that UEFA decided to award matches in Hungary a week before the tournament. These issues have been going on for decades. Was ESPN in a situation where they did not want to ruffle any feathers before the next bidding cycle for the European Championship? Question mark.
I don't know. I mean, Mike, those are great points. I think in particular I found the irony before we focus on ESPN of the English fans' behavior, which I agree was disgraceful. Quite frankly, their booing of their patronization towards Scotland and then their booing of the German national anthem turned me against them. I had been supporting them prior to the tournament. But the irony I find is that the British media was so consistently – painting a picture of, you know what, the Euro 2012 is in Ukraine and Poland. England fans, don't travel there. There'll be hooliganism. There'll be violence. There'll be racism. And then same thing before the World Cup in Russia. Oh, don't travel there. There'll be hooliganism, violence, racism. What ends up happening? That stuff happens in 2020 in a tournament England is hosting on English soil. So I find very ironic that the English press for the last decade has been quick to condemn other host nations, particularly in Eastern Europe, but then they don't have their own house in order. As far as ESPN not focusing on it, to me it's kind of inexplicable. I give Archie Rintutt a lot of credit. He was in Munich, right? For the Hungary-Germany game, which became a focal point because the Bayern Munich wanted to light up the stadium in Munich rainbow colors because Hungary was coming in the midst of this. He didn't shy away from it in his pre-match set piece, so to speak. But in terms of spontaneity and talking about it in the studio, it seems like it was glossed over for the most part. And then in terms of the England fan behavior in both the semifinal and the final, I don't know. I don't understand it because there has been so much coverage. And I criticized the British media, right, just now about the way they went into 2012 and 2018. But the British media has been very open about, oh, my goodness, we had a problem with the final. You know, we were close to not being able to play that match. There was too much happening with ticketless fans. There was too much happening with Italy fans being attacked. There was too much happening even at Leicester Square with flares. But yet it wasn't really discussed in on ESPN. So that is a really, I don't know if it has to do with this is the last tournament, Chris, maybe, of the right cycle.
I think
if that played into it.
I think partly that ESPN wants to present a great tournament and focusing on the soccer on the games itself and a little bit on everything around it, but for the most part it's mostly focused on the games and the talking points. That's what the vast majority of us want to watch and listen to. And I think, but in the back of their minds, they must be thinking, okay, well, Euro 2020, played in the summer of 2021, is the final one as part of the current deal that ESPN has with UEFA. And, of course, ESPN has the rights to the World Cup qualifiers from UEFA, so for the next year or so. For those games, but within the next year we'll find out who has the rights for the next Euro, so Euro 2024 and beyond, and maybe it is ESPN, and I'm sure ESPN's already had discussions with UEFA about wanting to continue that. So by ESPN focusing on the games specifically and not ruffling any feathers, that puts them in a good stance with UEFA and may increase the likelihood of a possibility that they could renew the rights for another 4 years or 8 years or however long it is. But I would say, though, Kartik, I think a lot of it, too, really, in fairness to ESPN, is just focused on resources. So, yes, you have Archie Rintutt, who's doing some work for ESPN. I wouldn't be surprised, too, if he was also doing work for Sky Sports News. I think he's done some stuff for CBS Sports in the past.
He's on The Guardian podcast all the time.
Yeah, so he's probably a freelancer, so probably not a full-time ESPN employee. So he's bouncing from position to position, doing things for a whole bunch of different networks. But the only person, really, that was on site across Europe was Sam Borden. And Sam, I have a lot of respect for, more so the kind of, he does a lot of the feature pieces, kind of like, the city of Budapest and kind of the history and kind of a piece about what's happening in, whatever it may be. But he's not the type of reporter that's going to focus on kind of feet on the ground. Here's what's happening inside, the riots or the hooliganism in England. I think you need a team of people going into some dangerous areas to kind of cover those stories. But so my thing is that I think it's more so resources. I don't think that they're set up to do that. They could be if they wanted to, if that's something of interest. And they could do a 30 for 30, or they could do a behind the lines. But also could be something that they do about the Mexican goalkeeper chants. there's a lot of, I mean, England's not the only country in this world that has issues with violence and racism, and these things came front and center from this tournament, because a lot of the games, a lot of the major games in this tournament were hosted in England, and with the COVID rules and the relaxation of those rules, in the UK, more so than most European countries, there's a lot more people in the streets. And with the UK and England having a very big drinking culture, things were bound to happen. And it seemed to be really poorly policed, especially the final. They were not prepared for any of this, which we saw too at Old Trafford, right, with the Super League protests, that the UK police forces and security were, I mean, just overwhelmed by the number of people coming to the stadium. So poor policing for sure, but for ESPN, I think it's just a lack of resources at the end of the day. I don't think it's a conscious decision to avoid these topics.
This having been said, and maybe it's again because they had Gab Marcotti on site with them in 2016, they were able to report on the hooliganism between English and Russian fans in Lyon, and also on the fights between Croatian fans, which was also related to the politics of the of what was going on in their federation at the time, the factions. In fact, there was a faction of Croatia fans who were trying to get Croatia disqualified from the Euros. And as it turns out, Croatia had a good tournament. They won their group. They beat Spain. They reported on site about that. I think part of it also, Chris, goes back to COVID and them not having reporters on site.
Yeah. But there was for the final, though. So the final, I was running late. I can't even remember what I was doing, but I was running late. And so like half an hour before the game, the final of Euro 2020 was ready to start, I was listening to BBC Radio 5 Live. So the main sports station, radio station in the UK, listening to that on TuneIn. And the commentators are there are saying, like, hey, we're hearing reports of people outside the stadium that have tickets, whether it's family members or whether it's colleagues, they're having tickets and they're extremely anxious because they're trying to get into the stadium. There's a whole bunch of issues. There's backup. The lines are backing up and it's really hard to get everyone into the stadium. And they're thinking at that point that the game may be delayed, because there's just a mad rush, a lot of people trying to get into the stadium with tickets. Then I get, so as soon as I pull into the house and switch on ESPN, then it's Kelly Cates and Stuart Robson in Wembley Way on a platform and saying, they said, like, well, things seem to be pretty calm here right now and things are moving along nicely. And we're really excited about the game. And Stuart, what do you think about England's chances? And Stuart Robson was like, I think England can win this game. They're really well, I mean, great in defense, strong in the back, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wait a second, did I miss something? Because I was tuning in late, did I miss like maybe a 10 or 15 minutes expose that ESPN did, said like, hey, there's some issues going on here? I don't know. So was that a conscious decision that ESPN made not to cover that? Did they not see it? Or did they say, okay, let's stay on script and let's focus on the discussion about the game and not talk about what's happening outside the stadium? And that's something that in the past, Kartik, I think we've criticized Fox for, especially during the World Cup coverage, especially during the coverage when it was in Russia, where there was a lot of incidents happening outside of stadiums. And I can't remember specifically what it was, but there was a lot of things happening around the games. And I think whether it was, wasn't it the blood tests for some of the Russian athletes? And there was a lot of controversy happening off the pitch, and we criticized Fox for that. This one seems to be, maybe ESPN did say, hey, let's not focus on that. Let's just focus on the discussion of these games. So which is not good. You have to cover all bases, I think.
Yeah, it wasn't good particularly because, as I said, as I said just a moment ago, I criticized the UK media for being very, very judgmental about Ukraine, Poland, and Russia going into those tournaments, and the things that they had the gloom and doom, the panorama program, everything that they had portrayed didn't come to pass during the tournaments.
Right.
But they were really embarrassed, I think. The day after the match, Monday, you know, part of the English media is like, oh, yeah, we lost on pens, and, you know, this was our best chance to win a trophy since 1966. But then the other half of the UK media is like, we're really embarrassed. We have a societal problem. We have an issue, a political problem, too. I know Gary Neville came on Sky and attacked the Prime Minister, blaming him for a lot of it, etc. But the point is, they confronted it, which I didn't really expect. I thought they were going to try and sweep it under the rug. So that made it even more glaring that ESPN didn't talk about it quite the way we would have expected. I have to chalk this up more to them not being on site with all their personnel.
They were on site.
A conscious decision like Fox to avoid it. But maybe I'm being too generous.
Well, for the final, they were on site, right? I mean, most.
Well, that's true. They were. And that's the game. That's really the game in question, because I think there were incidents, the Germany game, there were incidents, the Denmark game, but it was really an issue with the final. Once the curtain was drawn back and the next day we saw everything that went on, even at Leicester Square, post-game towards Italy fans, what happened in the stands. We have reports of young kids telling their parents, hey, mommy, daddy, if this is football, mom, dad, I don't want to go back. I don't like football. So because of what they were seeing around them at Wembley, and that was glossed over or just avoided.
Yeah, but mostly in most U.S. media, you would have missed it too. I mean, like, so the only parts that I saw of what really happened, or what happened for the most part, was through social media or through, I think there were a couple of blog posts from people within the industry that wrote about their experiences, and that they had been going to games at Wembley for the last 30 to 40 years, and this was the worst experience that they ever had, and they were fearing for their lives at times because of the lack of security and just fans rushing into the stadium, and that the capacity for Wembley was 90,000. I think the allowed capacity for this game was, what, 70,000, but there were estimations that there were well over 100,000 people in the stadium, maybe even much more than that. And there were pictures of fans just in the aisles, all crammed in. I mean, there wasn't a really accurate number of how many fans were in that stadium. You saw, watching the game too, how many of the England fans were standing through that entire game. And it might have been too, standing because of not just wanting to cheer on their team, but standing because lack of space. You mean, when it's, you can fit more people into a small space or a big space when everyone's standing instead of everyone sitting down. Listeners, let us know what you think about that one. That's definitely an interesting topic. And did we miss anything? Did you see something that is important to share with us in regards to what happened and how it was covered? Maybe it was different on the on Univision. Maybe they focused more on that. Copa America, Chris Guardino has a comment. He says, when it comes to Fox's Copa America coverage, I have to say that it was one of the worst tournaments I have ever seen covered on the English language side in quite a long time. I know that Fox was trying to broadcast the tournament cheaply, but in doing so, they completely forgot the importance of good production values when it comes to coverage. One thing that irked me about their coverage was the lack of a highlights analysis show, similar to what ESPN had for the Euros with Euro Tonight. However, the thing I was most disappointed with was the first few minutes of the final being on FS2. Due to a Major League Baseball game being on FS1 that was in extra innings, I was watching the final at a bar that neither had FS2 or Univision, meaning I missed the first few minutes of the game. No final of any tournament, in my view, should be moved to a secondary network. The interest around this Copa America was low to begin with, but Fox missed out on a golden chance to improve their coverage before next year's World Cup. Gold Cup. Greg says, hi guys, I really enjoyed the show and wanted to ask you to speak to something which is a major issue for the US men's national team. Every 2 years in UEFA and CONMEBOL, essentially, they get to partake, if they qualify, in a tournament that is taken very seriously with their first teams. The US basically only regularly gets to take part in the Gold Cup between World Cup cycles. In my opinion, there needs to be a tournament that aligns in timing with the Euros and Copa America and allows the US to play its first and best team within that international window. From what I can tell, there are really only a few options. Number one, make the Gold Cup at the same time as the Euros and take it seriously. We can't complain that we don't have the caliber of teams as Europe. We are not in Europe, and we will never be. We need to work with what is available. Also, consider making the Gold Cup occur in other countries to make it more of a valid tournament. In addition, let's not pretend the US men's national team is above all CONCACAF nations in level, because that is not the case. Number two, convince CONMEBOL to run a tournament with CONCACAF like they did in the Copa America Centenario. They didn't want to do this again for some reason this past time, but perhaps they could still work that out for future years. To me, this is the best option if they can convince CONMEBOL to do it. Number three, combine with a different confederation or multiple confederations to run a tournament at that time. Look to Asia or Africa. Granted, this would be outside the norm, but perhaps interesting and worthwhile if everyone agreed that it was going to be taken seriously. I just feel like every time the US plays, and it's not a World Cup or a qualifying game, it is always debated whether the game matters. I think they need other opportunities for games to truly matter, and that a tournament that is taken very seriously between World Cup cycles is crucial. I'd like to see more games where our first and best team is out there, and there is general agreement that the stakes are high, such as in the Euros and the Copa America. If you are a fan of the national team, it's just frustrating to only have the World Cup or qualifying games to really look forward to. Some great inputs and feedback there from Greg Kartik. This is a big topic. What's your initial thoughts about it?
Yeah, so first off, I think that an issue with the Gold Cup has been that it's played every 2 years and it's always playing the U.S. for monetary reasons. CONCACAF is trying to get as much money into the coffers to help fund and play it every 2 years to help fund the smaller island nations and help them generate some revenue. So often the out cycle, so that would be historically 9, 13, 17, now 21 have been B team oriented, whereas the A cycle, the in cycle where you're not going on, when there's no World Cup qualifying going on, which would be thinking back 7, 11, 15, 19, those Gold Cups have been generally A teams. So that's one thing. Second point, I like the idea of a combined tournament. It did not happen this time because of the U.S. Soccer Federation. The U.S. Soccer Federation went to the CONMEBOL nations and were very patronizing, saying, hey, you guys need our money, basically. Let's do a combined tournament in the summer of 2020. Turned out to be 2021 because of COVID. At the time, the South American countries were like, they thought it was very, very patronizing because the U.S. approach wasn't, hey, here's the sporting merit of this tournament. The U.S. approach under Carlos Cordero was, we can make you more money than you're going to make if you do just a South American tournament. And they were really put out by that. So we have a new president at U.S. Soccer, Cindy Parlow-Cohn. We have a new executive director, Will Wilson. It's no longer Dan Flynn, who was there at the time. Jay Berhalter, who was involved in that. He's now working with Major League Soccer. He's not at U.S. Soccer anymore. So maybe they can go back to South America and make that pitch again in a more respectful manner, and we'll have it happen. Because I agree, it would be great for both confederations, but it was the way the U.S. went about it that really irritated the heads down in South America.
Yeah, something needs to happen, though, Kartik. I agree with Greg, because you look at the Gold Cup tournament and you have a B team, Canada. You have a C team from the U.S. And yes, while it's great to watch U.S. beat Haiti and Martinique and Canada, it's not...
You had a U.S.-Canada game without Davies, without Jonathan David on the Canadian side, without right. Pulisic, without McKinney, etc. on the American side. It was like there was all this hype about Canada versus the U.S. and I'm thinking, well, the star players from both countries are missing. I mean, what you're saying, this is a rivalry, but the guys we genuinely want to watch are not going to be in this game for either team. It wasn't just the U.S. or just Canada; it was both teams. So yeah, sorry.
No, it's a good competition for those lower down in the ranks, and give them experience. But from the viewer's perspective, it's not a high-level competition. And if anything, it's probably better for the El Salvador's and Jamaica's and Panama's and Costa Rica's and Haiti's to get some really valuable experience in before for a World Cup. But I don't know, something needs to happen. I just don't see CONMEBOL, unless they're desperate for money. I mean, making a deal with CONCACAF, and at the same time, I don't see CONCACAF giving up some of their money too. Where, you mean, if CONCACAF hosts the events, then CONCACAF will get the majority of that money. But if they have to split it with CONMEBOL, and then they're going to get less money in their pockets, but maybe more overall. But then that requires a major, you mean, focus in terms of having games played, like the Copa America Centenario. That's a big undertaking to pull something like that off. I think it's status quo. I think it'll be that Gold Cup will just happen every 2 years, and it is what it is. It's not a very good competition for to get the U.S. ready for the World Cup. I mean, really, for the qualifying. Most of these players are not playing in this tournament because we need them for the World Cup qualifying, where it really matters. So it becomes a rather meaningless tournament. Not completely meaningless, but rather meaningless.
Yeah, you know, I think back to the Gold Cup in 2009, which the U.S. took a B team to, and had a Confederations Cup that summer. So which we don't have anymore.
I'd rather just see the U.S. play in Copa America. Have the U.S. go down.
Yeah. So my point was going to be, I came up with this theory at the time on the podcast, one of the podcasts we rolled into this podcast, Major League Soccer Talk, that, oh, you know, it's still great because we're going to get a real look at some guys that can help in qualifying when qualifying resumes. And at the time we had an August international break, so it was resuming right away a month later. As it turns out, Stuart Holden, who is now calling the games, Stu Holden was the only meaningful player that came off of that Gold Cup team that then kind of got integrated into the qualifying squad. So even though the U.S. had reached the finals, basically it was a completely different team than played in World Cup qualifying a month later. So, and I'm sure there's similar examples with other countries more recently with the Gold Cup.
So I would rather see Kartika prefer to see a foreign exchange program where the U.S. goes to play in Copa America and then CONMEBOL sends, I don't know, Chile, and Chile comes up and plays in the Gold Cup, and just kind of rotate it a little bit where you keep the tournament separate and give good experience to, I mean, kind of mix and match over the years as they go by. I don't think that's I don't think that is going to happen. It should happen, and if the U.S. wants to get quality opposition and get some really meaningful games, I mean, I'd love to see them battle with Brazil and Argentina and Colombia and Uruguay and Ecuador, etc., in a really, really meaty competition. All right, David has some feedback about Champions League and Paramount Plus. He says, has Paramount Plus announced if they will be streaming any preliminary or qualifying round games of the Champions League this season? Thank you for a great podcast. And yes, they have. So if you go to worldsoccertalk.com, we've got the schedule of all the Champions League qualifying games that Paramount Plus are showing, as well as the UEFA Europa Conference League qualifying games too. And there's quite a lot of games featured this week and next week. So check out our website for that. Bram says, Chris, you and Kartik's points about dedicated soccer fans perhaps not being CBS's intended audience are fair, but I'd note that other sports telecasts are critiqued based on whether or not the announcers take the event seriously enough in how they approach the telecast. So soccer should not be left out of that just because while its audience has grown in the US in recent years, it still hasn't reached the heights that those other sports have reached. Indeed, as far as soccer telecasts are concerned, I recall other networks, for example, ESPN and Fox, having relative soccer newcomers as game announcers on recent World Cups and Champions League matches, for example, getting flack for their perceived lack of quality. So why not demand the same as a viewer from CBS too? It's a challenge, I grant you, for a broadcaster to satisfy both diehard fans and newbies, but to my ears, CBS missed the mark by adding all that extra fluff and not giving the events at hand more respect, for lack of a better word, in how it was presented. And I think one of the things about NBC's coverage of the Premier League is that the way that they televised the Premier League from 2013 onwards, especially the first couple of years, so 2013, 14, and 15, is that they were able to not dumb it down, but speak intelligently to a viewership that would be, to an audience that the diehards would love it, and then newcomers would actually learn a lot from it too at the same time. So it is hard to do, to balance that, and I think they did really, really well in those first few years of televising the league. MLS topics. Bill Reese says, I'd like to give some praise for former MLS-turned color commentator Lloyd Sam. The former New York Red Bulls and DC United midfielder has been doing great work in color commentary on USL broadcasts, and he did a fantastic job calling the second leg of the Curaçao-Panama World Cup qualifier as a solo effort. He's my favorite type of color commentator. He's fun, he's relaxed, he's insightful, and when you listen to him call a game, it's like watching a match with a friend who knows a ton about the game and can drop in fascinating little tidbits. If Shep Messing ever decides to retire from color commentary for Red Bulls games, I hope MSG Network gives Lloyd a call. And Kartik, what do you think about that?
I worked with him very closely. With Miami FC, I was communications person, and he played for us. He finished his career with us. And there is a video of interview I taped with him, because I did interviews. I was also the on-air personality in addition to be the communications guy. That's what happens at lower division teams, right? You end up having to do both jobs, unlike MLS teams that have a dedicated comms staff and then a dedicated broadcast staff that's separate. So he was in the middle of a lot of our videos because he was so animated and was so analytical. And there's a sit-down interview I did with him, which is really good, in our Behind the Badge series from 2019. And then also when we opened the Miami FC Academy, have a lot of footage of him analyzing and coaching the kids and doing things there that was really good, that showed he was going to be a really good color commentator. Harrison Heath was the other guy that was really stand out in that video, the son of Minnesota United head coach Adrian Heath and former Manchester City and Everton star Adrian Heath. The point about Lloyd Sam, the other point I was going to make, is that I actually wanted to bring him in the booth for some matches when he wasn't playing, a suggestion that was internally vetoed. But I knew he was going to be really, really good, and he's been a pleasure to work with. I've heard from some of the people working with him on USL broadcasts. So yep. Big things expected for him. Thank you, Bill. That way, I completely agree, and I'd love to see him not just on Red Bull broadcasts, but maybe on national broadcasts for MLS and other things in the near future.
Yeah, my one to watch is Nigel Riococa, who's done some really good.
Oh yeah, I agree. Same.
Good co-commentary for a lot of the Copa Libertadores games for the World Feed. So he's one that's getting better and better. And of course, another former professional footballer.
Yeah, and Lloyd Sam, for those who don't know, was a longtime player in England in the lower leagues, Leeds United, among other clubs, and brings a wealth of knowledge of both English football and American soccer now to the broadcast booth. And by the way, before we depart the subject, Nigel Riococa has been so good on Copa Libertadores coverage, he's now getting plaudits in the UK for his work. So that's also good to see and hear, and a lot of people enjoying his analysis. And he's had to really cut his teeth in South American football, which a lot of English commentators don't, former players don't have to do. So he now probably has a greater library of knowledge than most of his former teammates that are doing co-commentary.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing too, is that in the UK, in England especially, a lot of the Copa America coverage and Copa Libertadores, I think, is on the BBC. So, but with the time difference, a lot of these games are on at maybe, like, I don't know, 1 in the morning, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. So it's not a huge audience, but I think it's actually interesting. It's kind of unusual to be seeing BBC doing that, but probably the rights fees to get some of these tournaments in the UK, there probably isn't a lot of demand for it. So it's a good way to for the BBC, who are strapped for cash, to get some rights to some of these soccer competitions and still provide those. And then, I mean, through that, then people can actually listen to, I mean, the Nigel Riococos of the world, etc. All right, listeners, we want you to have your say. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on the podcast thread on worldsoccertalk.com. Now, it's been a few weeks since we've done the last version of this show, so we definitely appreciate the feedback that you give. It really is what drives the show forward. So if you do have any questions about television coverage or what you saw or some of the things we talked about, or have any questions about streaming, etc., let us know, and we would love to read those out on air. So, Kartik, in closing, man, there's so much to get to, but of course, you got the Gold Cup coming up. You got the quarterfinals this weekend. You've got a whole bunch of friendlies from around the world. You've got the Olympics. You have the U.S. women's national team. The kickoff times, Kartik, are going to be a little bit difficult, though. So the kickoff times for the U.S. games are 4:30 in the morning, Eastern time. And then the second game, I think against New Zealand, is at 7:30 this weekend. And then the third game against Australia, I believe it is, I think on Monday or Tuesday, is at 4 o'clock in the morning. What about you, Kartik? Are you going to be watching those games, or are you going to be recording them and then watching them later?
Yeah, I mean, it's the only Olympics I'm planning on really watching is the U.S. women. Or actually, should say U.S. women. So yeah, I'm not.
Well, it's weird though.
I'm not really a fan of other sports, so as we talked about.
Yeah.
So I'll be watching the women's football tournament, and that's it. That's all I've watched the last few Olympics, honestly. I mean, I haven't even watched the men's football tournament for the most part.
It will be interesting because I'm not a fan of a lot of other sports, but every time the Olympics are on, the Summer Olympics, I always watch it with the family. So sometimes I might be watching the gymnastics, sometimes I might be watching the swimming, or kind of just the different events kind of at random, and seeing some of the amazing things that are happening from a sporting perspective, you mean, whether it's athletics, etc. This one, I have to say, this is probably the least advertised Olympics that I can remember. I haven't seen any advertising from NBC Sports.
Yeah,
I've seen very little buzz about this.
Yeah, I just watch 4 days of golf. I say I don't like other sports. I generally don't watch anything except for golf. These days, I'm not even really watching college sports anymore, which I used to a few years ago. But I went through 4 days of watching the Open on various NBC networks, some on Peacock, some on Golf, which is owned by Comcast, and a lot on NBC over the air, and saw very little Olympics advertising. And the talk about the Olympics was, oh, well, Colin Morikawa is going to represent the U.S. in the golf tournament in the Olympics. So that surprised me. Yeah, I didn't see that much Olympic advertising during the Open, which was at Royal St. George's, by the way, this year. So just for those who don't know the geography of England, you had within a week, you had the Euro 2020 final at Wembley, which is in northwest London. You had Wimbledon final, men's and women's, and all the finals, which is south of the river, really kind of southwest, south central London. And then you had the British Open this season, the Open this year at Royal St. George's, which is in Kent. Normally it's in Scotland or, of course, in Northern England. So London really was the epicenter of the sporting world for the last week, and they didn't host the Olympics. So that's kind of an irony.
Yeah, it just seems strange that I don't think I've ever seen any advertising for the Olympics and NBC. It's just normally you're just almost like sick of seeing the commercials and sick of seeing the hype.
Yeah.
I mean, it starts this week. So where is it? I don't know. But Yeah, well, for me personally, I'll be watching the games. I mean, the 7:30 game against New Zealand, I'll probably watch that live. The 4:30 in the morning and the 4 o'clock morning, I'll tape those and watch those later. But I don't know. I just hope that hope the buzz picks up, because this one might be underwhelming, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah, and also Liga 2 and Bundesliga Second Division kick off this weekend. I'm not sure about the Bundesliga matches being on ESPN Plus, but BN does have a couple of French Second Division matches in the coming week. So check that out.
As of recording this, which is Tuesday afternoon, I believe on Friday ESPN Plus will have the game that Schalke against Hamburg. Yes, thank you. Hamburg against Schalke is going to be the big game on Friday. And even though ESPN has not announced it yet, I believe they'll have that game on. They also will have the opening weekend of the Belgian Pro League on this weekend. There's a lot of soccer to look at. So go to worldsoccertalk.com or download the Soccer TV Schedules app on Android and or the iOS store, and you'll see the schedule for all the games available. There's a ton. All right, Kartik, so heading into another weekend of football from around the world, whether it's Olympics, second league of France, Belgian league, Major League Soccer, you name it, what are you going to do and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.